Welcome to Standard Intelligence. I am Dr. Jack Patton, and this week we're going to be talking about one of the newest, it's been around for a couple of weeks now, but it's been really making an impact as a good deck against the Lurrus Fires, Lurrus Urion Fires mesh that we've got going on in Standard at the moment, and that is Cycling as a very fast aggro deck. So I've pulled in outside help, someone who's actually played a lot more with the deck and has actually written an article about the deck. So I'd like you all to welcome Mark Gabriel to the show. And Mark, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Hi everybody, so I'm Mark Gabriel. I'm currently an author at mtgarenazone.com. And I think I'm 35th in the world in Mythic Points right now. And I'm also, when we are able to, I'm an SCG grinder, so you can find me at those if you ever go. And I just really love playing Arena. I love playing Paper Magic. I'm a lover of all things monocolored aggro, but really just aggro in general. And that's a little bit about me.
Cool. It'll be really interesting to get your perspective. I've had obviously a few guests on in the last few weeks, but we've been focusing very heavily on the UK side of things. So this will be a really interesting opportunity to get a little bit more of a global view of the way things are working at the moment, especially on Arena and things. So yeah,
absolutely.
Before we carry on, I should obviously mention the reason I get to do this every week is obviously partly thanks to you, our patrons over on our Patreon. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, please do head to patreon.com/SICast. And if you do decide to become a patron before the 2nd of June, you will be eligible for £15 of store credit giveaway thanks to our sponsors, Axion Now, who are open and they are accepting pre-orders, which I suppose by the time this episode goes out will be basically orders for Ikoria and singles. So go check axionnow.com out. Right then, Mark, let's get into it. That's the preamble done. Let's really get into this. So
let's do it.
Cycling, as I mentioned, it looks like it's a good fighter against the Urion and the Fires stuff. What do you think gives it that? Is it literally just the speed? Because we've got 4-mana sweepers in the format. What is it that's making this Cycling deck so strong?
Yeah, so I think if you just look at the payoffs, right, and you've got Drannith Stinger, Flourishing Fox, Valiant Rescuer, Zenith Flare. Those are kind of the 4 main ones. Drannith Healer is theoretically a payoff, but it's not really the one you want in your opening.
It's like the weakest one.
Yeah, absolutely. There's really a diversity of angles that it attacks the opponent from, right? So Flourishing Fox, you can just play it on turn one, and then it's just a massive clock by itself, right? Mm. So that's a thing, and you have to kill it basically immediately. And then there's like the Valiant Rescuer kind of thing where you just like go extremely wide. You force them to have a board sweeper, right? And they're good against completely separate things. Valiant Rescuer is excellent against something like 3-mana Teferi, right? Flourishing Fox is horrible against 3-mana Teferi unless you have like 3 of them out in play or whatever. It's a really hard deck to pinpoint like, okay, this is good against it, right? So most of them are creatures. So a good way to attack it is sweepers. Like I don't want to say that sweepers are like, you know, bad against it or anything, but you can't just be like, okay, I have a Shatter the Sky in my hand, I'm going to win the game. Because there's things like Zenith Flare in the equation too. And that's really what pulls the whole deck together, is that it just has this ultra mega War Leader's Helix in the endgame.
Yeah.
And it makes no sense if you just look at it, right? Like, I think the average number of lands the deck plays right now is something like 17.3. And it's every single game you want to be casting this 4-mana spell. And it's just like, how does that make any sense? But the consistency of the deck that it gains by just playing like 40 ops, basically, you know? It just burns through half the deck every single game. So those 17 lands, you really should be hitting your first 3 or 4 land drops every single game with it, even though it sounds like a minuscule number, right? Mm. So it's really hard to like pinpoint a way to really just be like, okay, I have Shadow of the Sky in my hand, I win. Doesn't work like that. I have, you know, something like 3-mana Teferi in my hand, I win. Doesn't work like that either. It's just, it comes to the opponent from a bunch of different angles, and they're all really individually powerful.
So yeah, as you say, it's very flexible in what threats it's going to provide. And yeah, as you say, some answers are going to be good against one half of the deck and just die to the other half of it. And then, yeah, I think that's a really nice way of looking at it, the massive War Leader's Helix at the end. that if you aren't gaining life, you aren't getting out of range of that thing. And I have seen a few games where it has literally come down to opponent goes, okay, I'm going to point this Zenith Flare at you for slightly less than lethal, and I'm just going to hope that I draw another one fairly soon. But because you cycle through your deck so quickly, you're just like, oh yeah, I'll find it quickly. It'll be fine.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So yeah, there's a ton of really really powerful stuff going on there. And like you say, the consistency is insane. You just don't see that from aggro decks, right? Unless you're playing just a million of the same cards. Unless you're playing 12 Lightning Bolts, you don't see consistency like this.
Yes, exactly.
Especially not in standard deck. So you started talking a little bit there about the like two sort of almost divergent game plans with Flourishing Fox and the Valiant Rescuer, and then you've also got the Stinger to power up either of these styles. Is that sort of how it plays out? You're like, okay, against this deck, it's a Wrath deck. I want to play one big creature and we'll try and make them run out their Wrath early, and then later on we'll just kill them with that. Or is it more just, I play what the hand's got? What sort of style are you choosing to play here?
Right, so it would be really, really wonderful if you could just be like, oh, I'm playing against, you know, mono red. I'm just going to get a Flourishing Fox out of range of everything, right? And they just die. It'd be really wonderful to just be able to do that every game, you know? But a lot of the problem that this deck runs into is that you just start with seven cards and you look at them and you're like, okay, well, if it's got lands and payoffs, I have to keep, because going down to six and five of this deck hurts a lot. So if it's something like two lands, two Flourishing Foxes, and three Cyclers, you're going to keep that. Even in a matchup where it's maybe not the best, you know, maybe they got a bunch of Sweepers and Teferis and stuff, and it's not really what you're excited about, but you just have to keep any kind of hand that has lands and payoffs, because I can't tell you how many times I've been like, oh, this hand is fine, but like, is Dranith Healer really where I want to be against Team of Reclamation, you know? And so I mulligan it, and it's just, you just mulligan to no lands, right? And then you get a five lander with the Dranith Healer and just one cycle, and you're like, well, that was the worst possible outcome, right? And it happens a lot with this deck, because it doesn't play that many payoffs, you know? Like, and Zenith Flare isn't really, it's not the kind of thing where you can just keep a hand with two lands, four cyclers, and a Zenith Flare. That's not going to get you anywhere. You have to have one of these early creatures. So there's definitely, like, in the back of your mind, you're like, this is really where I'd like to be in this matchup. But you kind of have to just make it work with what the deck gives you a lot.
Yeah. Is there anything that you're like, okay, now we have to switch things up? You know, when you see something on the other side of the table, you're just like, boom, okay, this changes the way everything works. I have to change all of my game plan. Or my game becomes focused around this one card that they have. What sort of cards are you looking at in that sense from cycling?
Right, so let's say you're up against an aggro matchup, right? There's that can be really rough. Like something like Mayhem Devil just blanks your whole deck. Like, it's, you're just like, you hope to Zenith Flare him a couple times because everything else is going to die, right? So against those decks, a lot of the time you see a lot of like things like Deafening Clarion or Flame Sweep in the sideboard. And if you just look at how the deck functions, it makes no sense. You're like, this just kills all my own things. Yeah. And how, like, why would I ever play this? But the way it plays out is that you can just hold things in your opening hand and cycle through the first couple turns, you know, just cycle three or four things, play a Deafening Clarion, and then your cyclers have found more cyclers, you play out your payoffs, and then you can start cycling more, and you've gotten like a 3-for-1 on turn three, right? And then you kind of start your game. And that's how it kind of plays out a lot. In addition, I'm trying to remember the name. There's like Thundermane Lion or something like that.
Oh.
And it's Savai Thundermane, that's it. And that card by itself completely changes how you play against aggro decks. You really, like, on turn three, you get three open mana and three cards to cycle. You want to cycle three times, right? It's just, like, feels right. It's what the deck should be doing. But that card is very mana intensive, but just, like everything else in the deck, rewards you for cycling in the best way possible. Let's say you're playing against mono red, right? And they have like 2/1, they have two Scorchbitters. You play this guy, it solidifies the board just by being a 3/2. And then you just, every turn, you cycle, which is what you want to be doing anyways, just like one thing, and then pay 2 mana. And you're just blanking their turns, right? You're just time walking them every time. It's really insane, but it slows you down a ton. And so it completely changes how you view the matchup. You're not like, if you have a Flourishing Fox, you can get it up to a 7/7 on turn four or whatever. That's great. But if you don't, and this is what you have, you know, the option of doing, then you just completely slow down and play control. You want the game to go until turn 20, and you want this thing to just be wrecking their board, right? So there are some things that can fundamentally change how the matchup is played. But for the most part, everything in your deck is so reliant on, like, cycling cards that it's hard to board into too much of, like, a different deck, you know? Because you have to have this critical mass of whatever it is, 28 cyclers or something.
Yeah, I mean...
Because none of your cards function otherwise.
I think that was definitely a mistake I was making when I played with the deck. It was going, oh, this is all just cycling chaff. Like, I can take out any of these and replace it with sideboard cards that are better. You're sort of forgetting that you're actually... It's such a big part of your engine that, no, you can't do that. There's actually a very limited amount you sort of get to take out and mess with things in the post-sideboarded games, which is kind of a really weird thing to think about from a deck that's like, oh, all of my cards just do this one thing. And you're going, okay, cool. Surely I can take a few out every now and again. It's like, a few, yes, but there's an upper limit to that number.
Exactly, yes.
So that's super interesting to see. How about up against, like, control-y decks? Are you... Because I've actually found that Narset, she has to be killed instantly, which I found hilarious. I was like, oh, this is supposed to be good against control decks, not the aggro decks. But as soon as you start cycling into my Narset, I'm going, okay, if you have to cycle more than once in a turn, you're just down cards.
That's exactly right, yeah. And I just about every single cycling deck you'll see at this point has at least three Fries on the board. And Fry is there for Narset, and you board it against Narset decks, and you don't use it unless they have a Narset. That's just like, you cannot ever beat that card. Yeah. It's incredibly difficult. It's even worse if you're playing Jeskai, because then you have Improbable Alliance, right? Which is literally actually turned off by the card. You know, you cannot trigger that thing with a Narset in play.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult to fight through if you don't have, you know, a massive board presence can attack it down immediately, or something like a Fry.
No. Okay. So yeah, I think that's a few of the kind of critical parts of the deck. Before we get into the Boros versus Jeskai sort of question, what is it that makes you enjoy it? Other than it being like an aggro deck and that kind of being your wheelhouse. There are other aggro decks in the format. I mean, you could be playing the Obosh Sacrifice nonsense. What is it about Jeskai or Boros cycling that's made you enjoy it?
So I like a lot of diversity in gameplay. I don't know if you're how familiar you are with Modern, but there's kind of been this eternal question about my favorite deck of all time, Modern Burn, right? And it's, is it an aggro deck or is it a combo deck? And it feels like the more experience someone has with the deck, the more they say it's a combo deck, right? You're trying to combine a bunch of things together to get one goal done, and it's going to be really difficult for the opponent to interact with in any meaningful way, right? Like, they can kill your Goblin Guy on turn one, sure, but then future Fatal Pushes probably don't have a target, and you're just firing things at their face. There's nothing they can do about it. So a couple days ago on Huey Jensen's stream, he was talking about this too, and he said, what do you guys think this is? Is it aggro or combo? And everyone said aggro, and he goes, I don't think so. I really think it's something completely else.
Yeah.
It's aggro when you draw exactly Flourishing Fox on turn one. That's when it feels like an aggro deck. And the rest of the time, it's really a combo deck. And what that is it's the deck diversifying the ways it attacks the opponent in such a way that it's, like, very difficult to deal with, right? Because you can board for an aggro deck and just die to getting Warlord's Yield to the face, right? Or you can board for a bunch of counter spells and just die to a turn one Flourishing Fox. It's really difficult for the opponent to interact with. And aside from that, I think it's just fundamentally, like, on a different power level from the rest of the aggro decks in the format. You're just drawing so many cards, it feels like you're always doing what you want to be doing, right? Because you play such the absolute minimum number of lands and payoffs and all that, and then you're just seeing your entire deck, right? So it's just, it always does what you want it to do.
Mm.
And you're going to see a Zenith Flare, you know, 70% of the time. And it's a really powerful diversification of where you want to be in the format. It's very difficult to look at a different aggro deck and be like, I'd rather be doing this, because it's probably about as good an aggro deck as cycling, and it just doesn't have anywhere near the power level of a Zenith Flare for 15, you know?
No, okay. I can see where you're coming from there. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you say, that sort of thing is really hard to find.
Right.
The companions thing has been talked about quite a lot recently. Obviously, they are incredibly powerful and in many cases very cheap, and in fact in this deck they're basically just free.
Yes. Yep.
Does Lurrus actually add anything, or is it just I get to play this because it doesn't actually cost me anything, so I might as well play it?
I was really shocked. That's certainly another big draw to the deck, is having Lurrus there. You know, that's something that a lot of decks don't have real access to. But That's something that surprised me, is that Lurrus doesn't do anything 90% of the time. And 10% of the time, it completely wins you the game. It's just absolutely insane. You're like, how do I possibly have access to this, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of the reason for that is that the threats are so powerful that if they have a shock in their hand, they can't just not kill the turn one Flourishing Fox, right? They can't like be like, oh, I'm actually just going to wait till that thing is a 7-7, and then they're going to play a Lurrus. I'm going to shock that instead. You can't do that. You're going to die. So they have to use all the removal on their stuff.
Yeah.
And weirdly, it's a 17-18 land deck, but you often, like I said, you often hit your first four land drops. So the play of turn four, Lurrus backs the turn one Flourishing Fox that they killed is really, really common. And then it's just like, you know, it's very difficult to deal with after that with any kind of removal. Lurrus just has to be killed immediately. And assuming that they've already used their removal, which they usually have, they just can't win the game. Now, most of the time, that doesn't happen. Most of the time, you either die or win by turn three. But it certainly just helps you win a lot of games that you otherwise would have no business being anywhere near winning.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was finding Lurrus underwhelming when I did a little bit of testing with the deck. But like you say, it's just so frequently that they have to do something before you've had your Lurrus turn. And this is one of very few decks that is playing Lurrus, at least in standard, in what I would call like a fair way. I've seen so many of the decks that are like all about the Lurrus, and they're, you know, putting Kaya's Ghost form on it, so you've got to kill it like twice in a turn to put it in the graveyard, and then they're just reanimating it out of the graveyard with Menace and Death Touch, and you're just like, oh, can this stupid dream cat thing go away? Whereas the cycling deck's like, no, I play it, I get a one or a two drop out of my graveyard this turn, and then if you haven't killed it, I do the same again next turn. But mostly the idea is that you have to deal with all my stuff before I've put the Lurrus down, so get wrecked.
A play pattern that shocked me with how often it comes up is Lurrusing back your own Footfall Crater to give like a really large Flourishing Fox haste. That comes up like half the games you cast a Lurrus. It really blew me away, but that's a very powerful interaction to be mindful of, because it just it happens so much that they have a huge board. You have a 7-7 that's doing, you know, more or less nothing. It's the Abyss, but it's abyssing 1/1 tokens from Omen of the Sun, you know. And so you just put a Footfall Crater on it and wins you the game on the spot. I was blown away by how powerful that was.
Yeah, the sort of combo there of Giant Fox and I giving it Trample when so many people are just going, oh, that's just another one mana cycler, is, it's incredible, actually. It's very, very good. Like you say, there's a ton of people that just want to chump it. And they can't anymore because you're going, I've got this land that means that you can't. So now you're going to get punched in the face for eight, even if you are putting 1/1s in front of it. The fact that it starts abyssing Uros pretty quickly is hilarious to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that can be pretty fun. Okay, so that's kind of like the basis of the deck, a lot about the play patterns that we see come up a lot, and you've noted some very powerful ones there. Jeskai versus Boros. This, I don't know, I've seen a lot of ways of thinking about this, and I have not yet decided which way I personally would come down. What's your thoughts on Jeskai or Boros?
So I was kind of on the fence about it. I read a really wonderful article from Emma Handy about why to play Boros over Jeskai, and it really convinced me. But they're both performing very well. I don't think that just for laddering purposes, like, you're going to be perfectly fine playing either one. But basically, Boros is just incredibly consistent. It does exactly what you want every game, and you're more or less always going to have a cycler. And Jeskai, it kind of fixes the problem of, like, when you just have two lands and a Dranith Healer and four cyclers, you're like, what am I supposed to do with this? This doesn't do anything. This plays a bear on turn two against control and then just doesn't, you know. So it kind of seeks to fix that problem by playing Improbable Alliance, which is probably the best payoff you can play, because it just doesn't really die to anything right now. It you know, kind of sneaks under Elspeth Conqueror's Death, doesn't get hit by creature removal. It's just kind of really in this nice little spot. Same with Lucky Clover. It's in that really nice spot that made it really good against blue-white control last season. It's like just sneaks underneath everything. So it's a really powerful thing to have access to. But what you find is that you're also going to get hands that are just three Improbable Alliances and three lands in a cycle, and you're like, I don't know what to do with this, you know? It limits the number of just bricks just dropped in your draw, right? There's, you just always, at any given point in the game, you want a cycle in your hand, right? And there's Zenith Flares and there's lands in Boros. There's bricks just dropped in the middle that, you know, if you have more cyclers, that's great. But if you don't, then you're just going to be looking at your fifth land. You're like, oh, you've got to be kidding me, right?
Yeah.
And so those are just bricks that just, you know, are plopped into your hand and it makes it miserable. And that's kind of what Improbable Alliance is too. On like turn five, when you have two Zenith Flares in your hand, you're just trying to get them to lethal. Your opponent's got a Fires of Invention out. You know what's going to happen. You just need to get this out before they start agenting your lands, right? And Improbable Alliance is not great then, but on turn two, it's so fantastic. And another thing that Jeskai gets access to, which is really cool, is that there a lot of the lands, which you have to add to make sure you always have your Improbable Alliance on time, cycle. There's the Jeskai Tri-Land, which is really, really nice.
Mm.
And it costs three to cycle, which isn't really where you want to be, you know, paying that. But it is like, it's a nice fail-safe to have access to.
Yeah.
It also gets really, really sweet sideboard cards. Like Mystical Dispute is nonsense. That card's a lot, right?
Yeah.
And so that's a really cool thing to have access to. You can counter your opponent's sweepers, things like that. You can counter your opponent's Teferi on turn three. That's like, that is exactly where you want to be with a card like Mystical Dispute. Aether Gust is also sweet, although it's kind of like not that great right now. I don't know what happened. It's a really powerful card, but just with the meta the way it is, it just kind of fell off. So you get access to these really cool, powerful sideboard cards, but what you also get access to is just missing a color. You know, that's something that happens a lot.
Mm.
You don't get to really play that many blue sources, so it's possible to get Improbable Alliance just stuck in your hand. Personally, for me, I always like to make my decks as consistent as possible. I want to play as few colors as possible. Yeah. I want to play as tight, you know, and just always have a cycler in my hand. That's really where I want to be. But I know a lot of people are like, give me the most powerful thing I can be doing. And if that's you, then I would definitely go with Jeskai. I personally, I've played them both. It's really, really close to me. But like I said, it's more personal preference than anything else. There's very, very valid arguments for both. And you're not going to be like just strictly wrong playing one over the other.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you that I like sticking with the version of the deck that plays fewer colors and therefore has a less likely fail state. You know, I always like enjoy feeling like I'm actually playing Magic, as it were.
Exactly. Yeah.
As soon as you throw in the very distinct possibility that you're just like, I'm just not going to hit my third color. I'm not going to play Magic. I can't leverage my play skill to get out of that one. That one's just luck of the draw. So if I can reduce the number of times that luck stops me from using my play skill to play a game of Magic, that's better. That being said, like you say, picking up, and it is just, it's Improbable Alliance. That card is insanely good. It's really powerful. It feels great in the meta at the moment, I think. So I can totally see it being a good reason to go it. But yeah, I'm kind of with you. And it also has to be said, apart from, like you say, Aether Gust not being great at the moment, which is a bit weird. And apart from Mystical Dispute in the sideboard, all of your other stuff I've got Mark's article up at the moment, folks, so I do suggest you go and check it out. You point out a bunch of really great sideboard cards. They're all in Boros for the most part, you know? It's
absolutely, yeah.
It's just so many good cards in just these two colors that you could consider playing for whatever meta you think you're going to be playing into. You've even identified a couple of like colorless ones, you know, you've got Spyglass in there and my least favorite card at the moment, Grafdigger's Cage.
Couldn't agree more.
So there's a ton of really great access there in just Boros. So why stretch that mana base? And like you say, picking up a Tri-Land, if it's a tap Tri-Land, it's not as great in an aggro deck. And if it cycles for free, it's not as great in a cycling deck. So it's not really doing anything you want it to do. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's... like I say, I'm going to point people who are listening to the article again on MTG Arena Zone, and it'll probably be linked in the show notes, so just check those out, because there's a ton of really great cards, which means that you get to test a bunch of things. And I kind of, before we move on, what's your like number for how many cards you feel like you're limiting yourself on sideboarding? I don't know if I mentioned this before the show or during the show, but I don't like taking out too many of the cyclers because you lose a lot of that reason to play the deck. Do you, do you like go, okay, I can board five cards and that's it? Or are you more like, okay, well, if it requires it, I'll board 10. What are you thinking?
100%. I'm the biggest proponent of this on earth. I just like just same 60, you know. I don't want to board a single card. Now, yeah, obviously, yeah, there's some really important things to deal with, and you have to have things like Fries against Narset decks, right? But I'm huge on just like it should physically pain you every time you bring a card in, right? Now, I wrote about two decks, Emma Handy's, and I can't remember the name of the person, but they did very well at the Magic Fest online a couple weeks ago. And they both had sideboards that were very, very clearly, like, it's very obvious what they're trying to accomplish with them. So I, in my sideboard guide, I was like, these people are probably smarter than me. You know, they did really well with the deck. I'm just going to go with what they seem to be trying to say with it. And so, like, against Mono Red, the Jeskai version that I had, I believe, boards in 9 cards. But at that point, it's more or less a different deck. You know, you're really boarding into control and just trying to go an entirely different axis, which is perfectly fine. But overall, I would limit yourself to 5 cards, no more than that. Make it 5 cards that you really, really want, because every single time you draw something that's not a cycle, you're just like, ugh, this is just the worst, you know?
I think I like that line of thinking, so yeah. Right then, apart from these cycling decks, what are you seeing coming up in the metagame that maybe people aren't talking as much about, or maybe we're already all on it with this Obosh nonsense, Urion nonsense that's been going on, where we're just cheating into play every agent of treachery we can lay our hands on. Where do you see the meta sort of shifting to?
So over the past couple of weeks, we've kind of seen this arms race with all the Agent of Treachery decks, just, you know, constantly trying to one-up each other. I think the Elemental Agent of Treachery deck was just hilarious, like trying to go miles over the top of everything else, and it went too far.
Yeah, it really
turns out it's not very good.
It really did go too far.
But it was at least funny to look at.
Yeah.
And you've just seen this arms race of everyone trying to go over the top of each other. And every time that happens, an aggro deck's going to come in and just punish it very, very hard, right? So I think that cycling has a very good chance of being that deck. Right now, the thing I'm seeing on the ladder all over the place is Team of Reclamation, which is really interesting to me. But that's a really good, like, go over the top of everything. Just, you know, explosion your face for 20 on turn 6. Like, you can do whatever you want. I don't really care. And it's got a pretty solid matchup against, like, the Jeskai Luka decks, the various Yorion nonsense piles. And so if Team of Reclamation's coming back, like, most of those decks don't play any sweepers right now. I really think that aggro is a good place to be. The place that I'm looking most right now is actually Mono Red Obosh. That's probably what I'm going to play in this weekend's Mythic Invitational Qualifier. Because it actually has a pretty solid cycling matchup. You play enough, I'm going to play 4 shocks for sure, because you need to be able to kill a fox on turn 1, but it's got a pretty good matchup against the rest of the aggro decks. Where I'm looking that I'm really scared is Teemer Clover, which I think is going to get hated out very quickly since it won last week, and black-red, like, sacrifice decks, easily your worst matchup. Not worried about that really at all, because it just gets destroyed by everything else in the meta right now. And then Jeskai Fires, which has, like, a 10% matchup against the Jeskai Luka decks. So that deck is nowhere to be seen, right? So those are the matchups I'm really worried about for Mono Red. And I think that it actually, like, I'm not worried about any of those really showing up right now. So I think it's just a good place to be. That's where I'd be looking.
Yeah. No, that definitely lines up. I played Obosh a couple of weeks ago, and yeah, I found Jeskai Fires at the time a bit tricky, because it was the Karuga Fires, and that was actually a lot better against us, I think. But with the Urion Fires, even when they wrath you, you're going, yeah, okay, whatever. They steal one of your lands, and you go, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. Like, I don't really care about your Agent of Treachery nonsense. It's, if I can beat you before you can beat me, it actually turns into a pretty weird race, from my experience. And sometimes that race goes your way when you're playing Obosh, and sometimes it goes Jeskai Fires' way. But it's a lot closer than it was with Karuga, I think. And then, yeah, absolutely, as you say, it's 100%. Got a good cycling matchup. I certainly found that. Like you say, you get a bunch of interaction to deal with. the Fox, and you get just a really good engine. It's the number of cards the sacrifice decks, certainly the black base sacrifice decks, draw is incredible. Like the amount of your deck that you see, mentally. I like that you're happy with Obosh. I might pick that back up again this weekend. I was enjoying that when I played it a few weeks ago.
The reason I originally looked at it is because it was like by far the best performing deck last weekend, which really blew me away because the cards look so bad in the you're playing like Grim Initiate and stuff, and you're like, what am I doing with my life? But they actually, it works out somehow. I don't know. It works out great.
I do know what you mean. I have a history of playing decks where people were like, okay, how does this deck even really win? I don't see it. And I'm like, it does. It just sort of does.
Exactly. It works out. I don't know.
Yeah. Don't ask me how Magic works, man. I've just played it for 5 years. I don't even.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's pretty cool. You sort of mentioned it there. The sort of resurgence of Clover decks, of Teemo Clover decks. Did it win at the weekend? I think it won. It certainly top eight.
Yes, it did. Yes, it won in the hands of Jason Ferrant, who's a co-worker of mine at an MTG Arena Zone. You should check out his articles if you can.
Yes.
But it won like in heavy quotation marks because Paolo had won the match, you know, and got screwed by the auto tapper.
Yeah.
But it did win, and I think that just like having that one next to its name means that everyone's going to have it on its radar. It's going to get hated out pretty easily, I think.
It's funny because obviously that happened after DreamHack last season as well. It's like it's sort of they're simmering under the surface, and then it gets a win, and suddenly everyone's just like, "Oh, I really wanted to play that deck, but I thought it was bad, so now I get to play it." I think it's secretly just what 50% of the field wants to always be playing, but they're like, "Oh, I'll go and play a good deck, I guess. Oh, it is good. I can play it again." So yeah, and I do not get me wrong, it's the deck that put me on the PT when the next PT happens, so I am definitely in that camp. But
absolutely, yeah, congratulations, that's fantastic.
Thank you. I don't know if it's doing the right things at the moment. Generally, like a lot of its onboard stuff is very susceptible to just being stolen and then your deck not doing what it needs to do anymore. And then all of the value things in the world only go so far when your opponent's just like, okay, well, I also have 80 cards and we'll be doing plenty of value-based things. Like, I don't get where you're at here. And like the no companion thing, because there are no companions that will work with that deck. The no companion thing is brutal, actually. It's
so
taking
rough.
Away it's an avenue that everyone else has access to.
Yeah, it's you're starting every game on a mulligan, even when you keep seven cards. Yeah. It's like it's awful. It's the worst feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll see what happens in Legacy, Vintage, and Brawl on Monday, and how Wizards plan on helping those formats out of the companion mess that they find themselves in. But we might have to consider that in Standard, if you're not playing a companion for the next 2 years, you're just handicapping yourself.
I absolutely think that's true. I still am kind of in shock that they got printed. I'm really curious what they're going to do in Vintage, because like you can't restrict it, really. It doesn't do anything.
Yeah, exactly. That was what I was thinking. It's like, okay, it's already restricted, or at least it's played like it. What do you even do?
Right, yeah, I don't know.
We had Charles Eliotambi, who's he's been on the Pro Tour. He's won Team GPs, a Team GP in Europe at one point, I think. He was on the winning team for. He very good Magic player in the UK. So if you haven't heard of him, it doesn't surprise me, but he is one of our better ones. And he was talking about the idea of erratering companion off of the cards and just going, these are cards now. These are Magic cards, but they don't have the word companion on them anymore. And it was a really interesting idea because obviously digital card games get to do that. Hearthstone gets to say, our cards don't do what we originally printed them to do.
Exactly, yeah.
But do we get to do that in Magic? Even if it is just for older formats where, yeah, okay, they didn't envision that interaction would be quite as powerful. It's like, I don't even know if we get to do that.
So Jim Davis, I don't know if you're familiar with Jim Davis at all, but he had a really great video out a couple weeks ago. He had it like the second day they were legal, which was really impressive. But he had a video saying, look, the like on the card, the things print on the card, for Loris. It says, Companion. Each permanent in your starting deck has converted mana cost 2 or less. If that card is your chosen companion, you may cast it once from outside the game. So he said, you can just, like, change the companion rules. It doesn't say anything on the card. It doesn't say, like, yeah, you start with 7 cards in your hand every time. Like, maybe if you just had to put a card from your hand on the bottom of your deck so it's not an 8-card hand every game.
Yeah.
That wouldn't change anything that's said on the card. You just, like, change a couple words in the rules. And then it's, like, a much, much more reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was... I tried to ask this question a couple of weeks ago. It was like, what part of Companion is the most powerful thing? That it's the 8th card, or that you definitely always have it? Like, if you go, okay, you can have Companion, but like you say, it's you're throwing away a card from your hand to put it there. Is that more powerful than just going, this is in your deck, you've got a deck building restriction, but you draw 8 cards at the start of the game? And it's like, I personally think the 100% chance of having a Lurrus on turn 3 is way more busted than just going, you have 8 cards in your opening hand.
Right. It's a hard question, right? Like, it's what's your favorite part of chocolate cake? I like all of it, you know? Yeah. It's all good.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'm still kind of in shock that it happened in the first place. It just seems like such an obviously busted thing to be doing. But here we are.
Yeah, man. I don't think I'd like to be in Watsy's seat at the moment trying to work this one out.
No, I don't.
Because whatever
so.
You...
Actually, a real...
Go on, carry on.
Go ahead.
No.
So real quick, I have a story. Back in college, I was doing terribly in a class. And the teacher... I don't know if you ever just like missed somebody, but the teacher and I did not... Like, we just weren't compatible. We did not get along. And I was not doing well in the class at all.
Yeah.
And our final project was we had to bring in like a creative person, right? We had to bring in like a director of creativity or whatever. And it was half our grade. And I was like, I have no idea what I'm going to do for this, but I really, really need someone cool because I'm going to fail this class, right?
Yeah.
So I emailed a bunch of people in the Magic community, all ignored me. One person was like, yes, I'll do it. And then they found out that they weren't getting paid and they were like, never mind. And they ghosted me. So it like was not going well. And I messaged Zach Hill, who is a former director of R&D. And he was kind enough to say, yes, absolutely. I'd love to talk to your class. And so they're supposed to talk for 15 minutes. He ended up talking to my class for an hour and a half. And he was the most kind, like, intelligent, just brilliant person I've ever talked to in my life, bar none. It was unbelievable how fantastic he was. And at the end of it, he like logged off. My professor said that like the speech that you guys just got, like out in the real world, would cost about $20,000. Like that was easily the best speech we've ever had in this class. I've been doing this for 30 years. That was like so far and away more intelligent and like, you know, insightful than any other person I've had. And I always think about that when I talk about like R&D decisions, because I cannot fathom how difficult that job must be. It's full of people like that, right? It's full of like the smartest people on earth. And it's like they're constantly making mistakes. It's like just every single set, there's something that goes wrong, you know? And it's like, this must be the hardest job on earth. If Zach Hill can't do it with 100%, that he printed Jataxian Probe. Like, if he can't do it with 100% accuracy, then I like, it's impossible to do. So I really want to be like mindful of that every time that I talk about like how could companions ever happen. It's like clearly something happened that like clearly they're just on a different level than we are. They're thinking about different things. There's different kinds of restrictions they must have. They're just in a different world than we are right now, because people this smart don't just like make that mistake, right? That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like you look at it and you go, this isn't what I would consider a classic mistake. This isn't, I often feel about this way about a lot of the way Magic is built. It's like, this isn't a mistake. It isn't, I oopsied here. It's, I have so many things to think about that I lost track of one thing. And it happened to be the thing that broke it. And it's, yeah, like you say, I also tend to try and be like as forgiving as possible about when we're like, oh yeah, this card, it was totally a mistake. And it's like, sure, but let's not, you know, most of Magic has been amazing. Let's not,
right, yeah,
you know, let's not crap on it for the occasional mishap when we all know why they're trying to do it. They're trying to give us something interesting to work with, a new idea, a new theme, a new way of playing Magic. And sometimes it doesn't work out quite perfectly because they lost track of one thing in the literal millions of cards we now have to consider while playing Magic.
Exactly.
So, yeah. No, I wouldn't want to be sitting in their seat this week because you're going to make someone aggravated. But maybe a little restraint on our part would also not be the worst when we're talking about this kind of thing.
Absolutely. I was just talking to my friend, Erin Barrett, who's going to work on card balance at Riot. And I was like, so Mark Rosewater put a question out on Twitter and he was like, should we focus on innovation or balance, right? Mm. And to a lot of people, they saw that and they were like, what are you really asking here? Because why can't you just do both, right? Like, you can make a card that, like, the text on the card is not affected by the converted mana cost in the top right. You can just add, like, one to Oko. That doesn't affect the innovation at all, right?
Mm.
So why are those separate things? And I talked to Erin about it, and Erin was like, basically what he's saying is there's only so much, like, time and energy they can focus and, like, you know, put into things.
Yeah.
And so the correct testing to find the balance on a card like Oko is, like, a lot. And they get it right 99% of the time. But what they're trying to do is, Oko is like a flagship card, right? Card's awesome. It needs to see play. That's something that a lot of people don't think about. But when you have a flagship card and it just sucks, it's just like Amara back in, you know, 2013 or whatever. It's really, really bad.
Yes.
It's like a really bad look. It really impacts sales in like a very negative way. And so when you have a card and they're instructed to be like, this has to see play. Obviously, like, you know, 9 out of 10 times you can do okay. But every once in a while, it's just going to happen. Like, there's nothing you can really do about it when you're aiming that high.
Yeah, no, there's, like you said, there's only so much you can do, and yeah. And again, going back to your thing of if it's a flagship card, it's hard to just go, we know that we need to ban this. Because they had the exact same problem with Emrakul, right? It was just, they got lucky that Emrakul wasn't 100% a problem until the set after it was a flagship card, as it were.
Absolutely.
So
yes,
you get that little bit of leeway of them going, okay, everyone's had 3 months to really ruin everyone's time at Magic, we should just get rid of this now.
Right. Yep. Yep, that's enough of that.
Yeah. Whereas when they, because it was, you know, it was Field of the Dead and everyone's going, look, this is insane, we can't do anything against this. I would have actually been super interested to see what would have happened if we just left it as it was, but that's a whole other set of issues. It's like, maybe if you leave it, it's fine. It's like, yeah, but people are crying out for you to do something, and if you don't do something, they're going to keep being annoyed at you. So if you do something and it turns out to be wrong, sure, the same people are going to be angry. So you haven't lost anything. But if you don't do anything, they're going to continue to be angry until the problem resolves itself. And there's no guarantee that it's going to do that. And then they sort of went, well, we can't ban Oko without having really seeing it, which was the other thing that a lot of people were suggesting, which was just ban it at the same time as you ban Fear of the Dead. And it's like, hey, you can't do that, because then you're saying this card that we all know has been really expensive and people might have played with, but it hasn't really had a chance to shine yet. If you're just going to ban it, people are going to get really annoyed at you. So,
yes. Yeah.
Like, they had a real tough time that season. And then, obviously, this one is going to be a pretty bad one I imagine, just for the fact that companions are so prevalent. And the weird thing is, in Standard, I think they're perfectly fine, right?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, there's Tier 1 decks, like Team of Reclamation, doesn't even play
well.
And it's like, they obviously wish they could, but the deck's doing perfectly fine without it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Right then, I think we've had a pretty good chat about a bunch of things tonight. Is there anything else that you wanted to hit on, Standard or older formats, while we're here?
No, not too much. I mean, play companions. That's the best advice I can give you. If you can at all do that, then do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Besides that, I think everything's about to be shaken up anyways. Modern is kind of not changing, but I think there's going to be bans fairly soon. It just is completely unsustainable right now.
Yeah. Yeah, Modern not getting a banning is kind of interesting, and it says that Wizards thinks that this is either fine or it's going to resolve itself fairly soon. So yeah, we'll see what happens there with Modern. Right then, I've actually got a few events to tell folks about. Sneak Attack is hosting another winner box this Saturday, so check out their Facebook page for details. I believe it will be the same standard £10 entry that it has been. Obviously, I am definitely not telling you this so that I can go ahead and win another half a box off of you, but do come and hang out on Saturday. It'll be great. And then Harlequin's Blackpool, they're running another one of their winner boxes. This one's a little bit further ahead. This is going to be on Sunday, the 31st of May. So clear your schedule that Sunday for that as well, because that should be an absolute laugh as well. Right, before we go, Mark, what do you think you'd be playing this weekend? I mean, you've given us some indications, and obviously you don't have to tell us because you are playing in the qualifier this weekend. But would you give us some indications of some decks that you might suggest to other people play?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Play every deck that my deck is going to have a good matchup against. I'm gonna be playing Obosh Red for sure. Cool. I think it's pretty good right now. Like I said, I was shocked, but it actually by far had the best conversion rate of any deck last weekend. Got a good cycling matchup, I think. Shock is weirdly pretty good right now. Bonecrusher Giant, still just a busted card. And I think that it's well positioned in the meta right now, and there aren't many Arboreal Grazers too. That's important. If you think you're gonna see a single Arboreal Grazer, do not pick up the deck. Because you just can't beat that thing. That thing is just unbelievable.
I can't beat this one mana 0-3 with reach ever.
Yeah, I'm like a lifetime 0-2000 against that thing. It's too good. So yeah, I would absolutely suggest picking up Obosh Red, and if not that, then just I think cycling
is a place to be.
If everyone's playing Team Wreck, you know.
Oh, brilliant. I'm still not 100% decided. I still like Obosh Black, but at the same time, Urien Luka Fires Agent deck that I think we just need to continue adding words to. I'm still really enjoying it. It has some awful aggro matchups at the moment, I think. It dies generally pretty badly to cycling, although I've got a really nice sideboard strat where I take out all of the agents and all of the ECDs, bring in a bunch of Wraths and Dream Trawlers, and that works surprisingly well. Okay, I'm going to guarantee myself a Dream Trawler on turn 5 if I can hit the couple of cards that I need, and then game 5 at least every turn is sort of the game plan there. And it can work. It did work last weekend, but it doesn't necessarily have to. So it's a plan, but it might not be a good one.
There you go. That's all you need.
Yeah, exactly. As long as you've got a plan, it doesn't even really matter if it's a good one.
Right.
You know what you're doing. Right. Yeah. Right then, obviously, before you go, Mark, why don't you let people know where they can find you, where they can find your articles. Plug yourself, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find my articles on mtgarenazone.com, which is a really wonderful website run by really fantastic people. You can find me on Twitter at Gabriel_Mark. Feel free to email me, markgabriel1@gmail.com, for really any reason. Like, we're all going through some stuff right now. If you just need someone to talk to, feel free to contact me. If you want to, you know, magic advice or anything, you know, absolutely feel free to email me, shoot me a message on Twitter. It's all good. And also, just real quick, shout out to Community Solar, which is my job, like my day job. It's a really cool thing. If you can look into it, if you happen to live in New York, feel free to contact me. I can sign you up. But it's basically a way to go solar and also save money on your electric bill for, you know, very little investment at all. So it's really cool. And that's basically what I'm up to right now.
No, great. Thank you. Check that out, folks. Obviously, if you want to see anything more that we're doing, standardintelligence.uk, and I will be getting the calendar back up and running with the online events going forward. So if you want more information about UK MTGA or MTGO events, then head over to there and check out the events page. And if you want to talk to me, I am at JackPatton42 on Twitter as well. Lastly, another quick reminder about our Patreon. This podcast is obviously brought to you thanks to the support of listeners like you, who happen to also feel that the podcast gives them enough value that the kicking in a couple of quid every month is not the worst thing in the world. And if you do join the Patreon, patreon.com/SICast, before the 2nd of June, then you will be eligible for our £15 Axiom Now store credit giveaway, because Axiom Now is also a sponsor, and you should definitely go and check out their singles. They've got Ikoria on sale now. Go and have a look. Right then, once again, Mark, thank you so much for being on. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It was fantastic.
Cool. And thank you all very much for listening, folks. Goodbye.
See ya.